being in balance. And so, you know, we center being in relationship with not only one another as human beings, but we are trying to be in a really good relationship with all my relations. And so we don't even, it's not a human centric concept. It's to recognize that there's a lot of relatives across this, you know, across our world in terms of, you know, the land is our relative, the water is our relative, the animals, the trees, like those are all of our relatives. And so, you know, we talk about Mother Earth, you've probably heard Grandmother Moon, you know, so on and so forth. And so we're trying to, you know, the endeavor in life is to think about how am I in a good relationship with Mother Earth? How might I be in a good relationship with Mother Earth? And so it's not about controlling Mother Earth. It's not about, you know, how can I extract every ounce of her energy? Like it's not that kind of a perspective. And so when you're talking about your ethical funds there and your social return on investment, it's very much what I think that's trying to get at, right? There's other ways to measure success or to measure good, you know, and to measure purpose. And so that's a worldview, an Indigenous knowledge system that says, you know, we're all here together. You know, we all live in this ecosystem. We're super interconnected. What happens to one happens to all. I don't know about you guys, but I'm watching the news like nonstop about COVID. And, you know, we're saying, oh my gosh, you know, this variant's here. Like COVID is such an example of how interconnected we are, right? Because these little things that are microscopic are coming into our lives and they're having this kind of an impact in our lives. They're shutting down economies across the world. Who would have known that something so small could do that? So again, such interconnectedness. And again, you know, Indigenous people, I think I wanted to circle back to that land acknowledgement that Indigenous people have been living, you know, in harmony with this land for a long, long time. And so when non-Indigenous people did come to this land, you know, it was, and it still is, I mean, it was beautiful country, beautiful land. And then, you know, there was obviously opportunities to prosper and to live a good life. And so, you know, we engage in enterprise and we start doing things to the land to try to make our lives better. And, you know, I think when we talk about the treaties, I think recognizing that people were here before and they had a certain way of viewing even property, like we didn't really necessarily have this. When non-Indigenous people come here, there weren't fences and there weren't flags everywhere. And so I think there was this, you know, misinterpretation that, oh, this must all be free land because there's no one here or there's no fences around things. And so again, it's just that there isn't a concept of owning land. There was a concept of being responsible to care for land and to care for territories, and that people were, you know, living on those pieces of land for a long time with, you know, living in that interconnected balance. And so, you know, we want to acknowledge and honor that that was what happened. And so when non-Indigenous people did come, you know, they were able to prosper off the land in the way that we did. And so, you know, Kemlyn, also in there, you said, you know, we want to acknowledge the past harms. I have two daughters and one of them is 12. And I went to her classroom today to do a talk that her teacher asked if I'd come in. And one of the young kids said, well, you know, if this, you know, we're talking about all the negative statistics that are around Indigenous people. And the young girl said, well, you know, what can I do? And so she said, we were talking about how those children in that classroom did not conduct the harmful behavior of the past, but they're living here today. And so what might they do? And so we had this conversation about they didn't commit those harms from the past, but they are still benefiting from those harms, right? And so it's us trying to understand how to this day we benefit. And I don't know how many folks know, but our water comes from Shoal Lake 40, right? Which is in Treaty 3 territory. And there's, if you ever get a chance to watch this film, it's called Urban Eclipse. It's by Jesse Green and his wife, Vonda Green. It's an amazing film. And it talks about, I think it was like in 1919, somewhere in and around there, And I want to say it was Deakin, but it might not have, I'm not sure which one, but it was somebody who was running for mayor, who really ran on the ticket of getting Winnipeg clean water, because at that time, Winnipeg did not have clean water. And there was, and it sort of spells that I might get all the detailed facts not exactly correct here, but you got to watch the film. It spells it out. But more or less that, you know, we had businesses in the downtown of Winnipeg, and the business community of Winnipeg had kind of stalled out because we didn't have clean water. So citizens were getting the Red River fever or whatever, right? And also insurance companies would not insure businesses because the water that was being used out of the river every time there was a fire was actually a flame enhancer. So businesses couldn't get insurance. And so there was a real pressure to get Winnipeg clean water. And so at that time, you know, our elected officials for Winnipeg did end up creating a deal with our federal government and our federal representatives. And they went into Shoal Lake and they just did atrocious things to Shoal Lake. And those things are still there. They cut that community in half. They just built the aqueduct. That community did not at all get any jobs out of that. Like, there was no economic benefit to that community whatsoever for the building of the aqueduct so Winnipeg could get the water. And to this day, that community does not have clean drinking water, which is the case for many, many First Nations across this country. That is ridiculous. There's no reason that every community in Canada can't have clean drinking water. That is ridiculous. Like, that is a political inaction right there, right? So Shoal Lake still does not have clean drinking water, but all of us right now probably can go shower and turn on our water and wash our dishes and so on and so forth. And we have clean drinking water. We can drink it right out of our tap. Yet Shoal Lake can't. And so to this day, Daryl Redsky was also, he's a community member from Shoal Lake 40. And he's in that film and he says, you know, every little bit of concrete poured has to be mixed with water. And so all of Winnipeg, he walks around the sidewalks, the buildings, everything that's concrete, that was made with Shoal Lake water. And so again, Winnipeg, you know, has prospered, right, off of the water. And yet Shoal Lake hasn't. It's devastating. You should, if you've been to Shoal Lake or you see the footage of Shoal Lake, it's devastating. There's some stuff on National Film Board you can watch about it. So there's that, you know. Secondly, I'm right now on my screen and and I've got my mom is sitting here and she's watching the TV. Like, we're enjoying electricity. And if you go to Manitoba Hydro's website, it'll say there that 70% of the electricity generated in Manitoba is from hydroelectric power. And so that hydroelectric power is generated primarily off the Nelson River, which is in Treaty 5 territory. So once again, we have built these mega dams in our northern community. And who was it that was saying hi from the north? A gentleman on the call. So we have these mega stations in the north that have completely disrupted communities. And again, I don't know what all the metrics are, but I hazard a guess to say that most of our Indigenous First Nations communities that were either dislocated or, you know, affected by the development of our hydroelectricity probably did not get very much economic benefit from the generation, from the building of our dams and from our hydroelectricity to this day. Our First Nations communities just don't benefit from these things. Yet as a province, we've prospered because of Manitoba Hydro, right? We prosper, like, we're selling our hydro down south, right? Our excess hydro, we're selling it to our southern neighbors. So there's a benefit there. So that's part of, you know, for us all too. And I know, again, given your Jubilee Fund, right? So given that, how is it that we participate in the continued harms of the past, right? And that's just a personal question for each of us to ask ourselves and to think about how might I then be part of the solution. And so that young lady was saying to me, the idea of, I don't want to be moving forward. I don't want to be seen as part of the problem. Like, how am I part of the solution, right? And that was sort of was a really great reflection and question. And so I think that's the social injustice of the world. And I have done a TED talk and I've spoken quite a bit about this, and lots of people have, like, lots of people do know this and talk about this, but when you look at data and statistics, they particularly around Indigenous people, they're quite awful, right? So in 2018, for instance, I cite that, you know, 11,000 children in the care of Child and Family Services, and 95% of those children are Indigenous. When, you know, the Indigenous people make up, you know, 20% of the population, maybe we're closer to 25 soon, but like, how can the 95% of the kids in care be Indigenous? How is that possible? That system in 2018 costed upwards of $500 million. So again, somebody is benefiting from that system, right? $500 million is going somewhere. And if you look at where it's going, by and large, it is not going to Indigenous communities. Yet that whole system is set up with the goal of keeping children safe and protecting children. That's what it's supposed to be, right? Child protection. When you look at more and more data that's coming out, it's actually showing that that system is quite harmful to children. And so there's data starting to be generated now that shows the longer that children are in the care of child welfare, the worse their health and wellness outcomes are as they get older. So when they're exiting out of that system, they're more likely to be unemployed. They're more likely to have mental health issues. They're more likely to have all the negative health, you know, issues, risk of being homeless, you know, lack of education, like you name it, all those health and wellness outcomes are quite negative the longer you spend in the child welfare system. So it begs the question, is this system here to help families? Is it here to help? And I'm not laughing. This is ridiculous. You're hearing it. So it's not a funny subject. And that kind of an analysis holds for every system. If you go to the justice system, same sort of story. Conservatively speaking, 75% of those who are incarcerated in our Manitoba justice system are Indigenous. Yeah. Like, again, I can go to the health system. I can go to the education system. Every system, these are the numbers. And so it starts to, in my opinion, that points to structural racism. Those numbers are in place because there are systems in place making that happen. And those systems are all super expensive, like the justice system. I don't know what the budget is around that. Somebody is benefiting, like somebody is being employed. Like, so there's judges and lawyers and social workers and, you know, in child welfare, there was like the hotel industry, you know, we were putting kids in hotels because we couldn't find families for a while, right? So if you follow the dollars, somebody's benefiting. And so I used to go around saying, oh, the systems are broken. The systems are broken. And then somebody corrected me. And I think it was Cindy. What is Cindy's last name? She's heading up all the First Nations Caring Society, and she's challenging the child welfare system and challenging the courts all the time. And she corrected me and said, the systems are not broken. The systems are working exactly as they were set up to work. And that's very insidious, right? That's like, to think about that is quite awful. But you know, there's a truth to it. And so all of those numbers like that, you know, 75% of those incarcerated are Indigenous, you know, 95% of kids in care are Indigenous. Like our infant mortality rates or our mortality rates even. So again, you go to any of those numbers, that speaks to the complex social challenges that we're facing and that we're dealing with. And so that's, again, what Boldness is about, is trying to say, well, we need to tap into Indigenous wisdom, because by and large, it hasn't really been tapped into. And why we call it innovation is to say, we're going to use this wise, these wise knowledge systems and practices that have been around for millennia. They're not new, but we're going to use them to try to address the current day challenges and systems. That's the innovation, right? Using Indigenous approaches is the innovation about, you know, there's these different ways that we might go about tackling these issues. And so Boldness, we're 7 years in and we're up to about 12 prototypes that vary, you know, some prototypes are super well developed and others are just starting. But it's really centering Indigenous wisdom in our solution finding and saying, you know, and so a lot of our prototypes, as you can imagine, are dealing with, they're providing an alternative and a solution to the child welfare system. And so we're, you know, saying that if we think about what does it take to make families healthy and whole and to think about families thriving, here's all the things we need to be doing to make that happen, which is different than saying, I truly feel like many of our systems, you know, our housing, our social assistance, you know, all these systems that are designed to, again, they're supposed to be there to help, right? They're designed to help people. And a lot of the times they aren't helping. And at their very worst, they're harming. And I fundamentally believe that part of that reason for that is because we don't actually talk to the people who we're creating those systems for. We don't ask them what they think. We don't ask them what they think the problem is. We definitely don't ask them what the solution is, and we don't involve them in any of it. And so that's, you know, as an Indigenous person who's been working in the North End for primarily Indigenous organizations and with Indigenous families for most of my career, I can tell you, like, we get hardly asked. We get presented with solutions all the time. Somebody will bake us a beautiful cake and they'll bring it to us and they'll go, look at this beautiful cake. I you know, because I'm pretty sure you like cake. So here's this beautiful cake I baked for you. And then they don't even ask us if we like cake. They don't even ask us if they want cake. You know, they don't, like, we don't get asked those questions. So what is the problem? We don't even get asked what the problem is. And therefore, you know, we don't get to determine what the solution's going to be then. And part of my, theory or not theory, I use a lot of metaphors, and a lot of it I'll say, you know, we'll go into the community and say, okay, we heard coffee's an issue, so let's start, you know, doing our design jams and, you know, design sprints around coffee, like using all these social innovation processes and tools. And nobody bothers to ask if coffee's actually the problem, you know, and our community comes along and we'll say, it's not really the coffee, it's like the cup, it's the container. It's really the container that's the issue. It's not actually the liquid. And so, but we're so busy building better coffee that we don't ever pay attention to the container, right? And we just assume the container's not an issue. But if we actually talk to our families, they'll tell you, no, it's the container. So that kind of an example happens all the time in Boldness. And so when we wanted to look at educational outcomes. And so it was 0 to 6 and, you know, educational success of kids. We went right into our community right at the front end and said, you know, how might we make it better for children, you know, for educational success? And right away our community said, why would you only focus in on education? Like, we want children to be well in all aspects. Why would we only focus? And so they really schooled us on the concepts of interconnectedness and holistic thinking. They're like, don't be pulling out one little thing and working on that one little thing. You know, children are whole beings. You have to address their whole being in what you're doing. And so we went, oh, okay. Then it became about, okay, well, how do we make it better for children versus how do we make it better for children in education? And then I think a lot of those systems I was telling you about, they're really built on this concept, this belief, I think, belief that people don't want to do better for themselves. And this belief that if we give them too much, they'll become dependent and they'll just sit around with their feet up, you know, eating bonbons all day, which has not at all been my experience in the North End at all. And so what we do is we design those systems for survival, just enough. Let's just give them enough to keep their nose just above water. And sometimes actually not, like, we need their nose to be a little bit of below water because we need them to then, you know, get their nose above water, right? So a lot of our systems are designed for survival. So again, housing, social assistance, you name it. When we talk to our families about, you know, how can we, you know, do things to create health and wellness, good health and wellness outcomes for children, they immediately talked about thrive versus survive. And when you start thinking about how might we build systems to build thriving children, it is a very different conversation than if you're having a conversation about how might we help children survive. So we're innovating for thriving versus innovating for surviving. And that's a very different conversation, right? Again, who gets to center, you know, those things? So that's another big piece that I talk about a lot, is we need to involve the folks we're talking about. They need to be a part of the problem definition. They need to be a part of the solution finding. And then they need to be involved in all the different ways, from top to bottom, from side to side. And I appreciate your video when you know, in there it says, you know, we're not giving handouts, we're really into giving hand ups. And I would push that a little bit further to say, you know, we really are moving into an era of the handshake. And so recognizing that, you know, past harms have created the inequities that we have today. And so if we're going to try to address those inequities, we really need to be thinking about handshakes and collaboration versus this concept. Because hand up, in my opinion, is still a little bit charitable. Hand up is still kind of got that power imbalance to it. Like, I have something I'm going to give you a hand up with, right? Versus recognizing I have something to bring, you have something to bring. Let us have a handshake and let us move forward together, right? And so part of one of my TED Talks, I use these analogies because I think they sort of land every now and then. And it was the, you know, give a person a fish. And then if you teach a person to fish, and I'm pretty sure this is a proverb that came, I'm pretty sure it was a lady out of Africa who said, but what if the water's polluted? And so it isn't about your individual capacity, you know, teaching you to fish or giving you a fish. It's not about your capacity. The lake is polluted. So that speaks to structural barriers. That speaks to, you know, having a systems view on why people are suffering the way they're suffering. It's not because they're not working hard enough. It's not their individual capacity. By and large, there are systems in place that are keeping those barriers in place. And so I like Pareto. And so I use it a lot, and I go to the 25-75, and my experience in the inner city has been 25% of the time families will ask you for something that will help them build their individual capacity. They will want a parenting program or a budgeting program or, you know, something that's going to help them build their skills 25% of the time. 75% of the time, they want to give back. And they're looking for opportunities to apply their gifts. And so a lot of those of us who have been running inner city organizations, before Boldness, I was the executive director at Mom Wichita Center. And I worked under the mentorship of Josie Hill, who was the former executive director of Mom Wichita Center. And she had passed that baton to me. Our job was not to like really deliver programs to the community. Our job was to create opportunities for the community to participate with their strengths. So we had really robust volunteer programs because 25% of the time the families would ask for something quickly, super quickly, they would turn around and want to give. And so they 75% of the time they wanted to help, they wanted to volunteer, they wanted to, you know, they wanted to work, they wanted to, you know, so this idea that, oh, if we give them too much, you know, they're going to get dependent and they'll just sit around and do nothing all day. Like, that is such a fallacy. Our folks want to be productive. They want to, you know, contribute to Minobadzuin. They want to have a role. They want to feel needed and valued and, you know, and all the things, which are all very human things. So we challenged ourselves to figure out, how do we create as much opportunity as possible for everyone to participate in the way that they can participate? If participating means you show up here once a month, great. If participating means you show up here every single day at 5 a.m. and want to unlock the door, great. we find the ways, right? And everyone's different. I will say that in the prototyping with Boldness for 7 years, every single one of our prototypes, our community, hands down, is asking for customization, hands down. They are not asking for standardized approaches. They are not asking for universal approaches. They want standardization. And I'm pretty sure, I feel confident that we can do customization at scale. I think we can. I think we're really smart people. I think we can figure that out. And so how can we do that, right? And so, because families do it themselves, like families jump immediately into equity. If we're sitting around and we only have X amount of food, say, and if I say, okay, all of you get one apple, that's it. That's equal. the families will quickly regroup and go, you know what? That family needs three apples. I don't actually need an apple. I'm giving my apple to that family. Like, families redistribute quickly when you see them in the neighborhood. They take care of each other and they help and they move to that equity place quick. And they're not, you know, upset about not having an apple. Like they willingly give that family those three apples because they need it, right? And so we can do that. And so that's, you know, when we are designing our programming and our services and our resources, can we do that based on principles of equity and customization versus sort of a standardization and equality? I would love to get to equality, but we are so far away from that. So for me, boldness, we lean into, you know, equity work so that someday we will get to that equality place. Kemlyn or somebody, can you give me a time check? I was trying to pay attention to time and I didn't. So you just flag me. I can talk to you guys for 5 days if you let me.
You're muted, Monica.
The theme of the past year and a half. A few more minutes, and then if we could head into Q&A, that would be great.
Okay. So yeah, so those are my biggest takeaways is like involve the families that you're designing for, or like if the Jubilee Fund is designed, if you're hoping it's going to benefit somebody, who is that somebody? And can they, you know, somehow inform your work, you know, again, from top to bottom, from side to side, right? Like how are you doing that? And then looking at the benefits of it, right? Like, and that gets into the EDI stuff, right? The equity, diversity, and inclusion stuff about, you know, who's on our board, who are we employing, you know, who's our volunteer base, like, you know, and then ethical investing is where are those funds being invested? And I know you guys are on that one in a big way. So yeah, it's really having a view. You know, when I talk about Indigenous knowledge systems, I do say that in this era of TRC and truth and reconciliation, lots of us as Indigenous people say, you know, we have to get through the truth. We have to get to the truth and into the truth before we can have the reconciliation. And that truth telling and hearing is, it's hard, right? It's hard to hear that stuff. And it's traumatizing to tell it and hear it again and to, you know, and so we really... Yeah, again, I have a social worker background by training. And so there was a time and there is a place for safe conversations. But I really feel like if we're going to get into this stuff, A, we have to have strong, strong relationships. And when you're in strong relationships, you can have the toughest conversations and you can get through them intact, right? And you can like get to solution finding in those tough conversations. You can really lean into tension when the relationships are good. And so, you know, we talk about the seven grandfather teachings. I'm sure many of you have heard of those. And one of those grandfather teachings is about courage and bravery. And so for us to, I mean, it's good to have safe conversations, but sometimes like, who is it safe for? I'm in unsafe conversations all the time as an Indigenous person, as an Indigenous female. And so instead I talk about maybe we need to create space for brave conversations, right? Let's have brave conversations. And we can have braver and braver conversations when we're in those really solid relationships. So to me, it's always about form really strong relationships with people. When you're in those strong relationships, people will forgive your every blunder, no matter how big, right? Like people can be very giving. They'll give you a lot of room to be you. And then to, you know, and then in that relationship space, you can work together to figure it out, right? That's the handshake part, right? You can do the handshake with each other and you can walk together to constantly, you know, problem solve your way through because the problems of the day change, right? And so we're constantly having to like iterate and emerge and figure things out. And, you know, we talk about being responsive and so on and so forth. And so creating space for some of those approaches, I think is best done in really solid relationships. So maybe we'll stop there and see how that sits with people and where does that take you? And, you know, what are some comments you might have or thoughts or questions?
Okay. Thank you so much, Diane. That was, yeah, really, really thought provoking. And also really, really hopeful too at the same time, and just really clear in terms of, you know, I think a way forward in lots of ways. And yeah, there's just, you know, as you were talking, I was just thinking, God, there's so much history that we aren't taught, first of all. So many, and it's easy to forget these things too. That's the other thing. So much direct and so many direct and indirect impacts on Indigenous people, on Indigenous families and communities, and the interconnectedness of all these things and all these impacts too are, you know, huge. And, you know, I think, yeah, like to me, the way you started too, to me, hearing you, the way you started really, really, it illustrates that that's the solution, right? That it's not about a hand up, it's about a handshake, which in effect is the essence of what the treaties were, right? Like we, you know, the settlers had came to the table with something, and Indigenous people came to the table with something, and that understanding was put to the side, right? And so, yeah, there's just, I could talk, I could have a whole conversation, but I will open it up to other people for questions. So I'm not exactly sure how we're gonna do this though.
So Kevlin, you have a couple of questions directly in your chat.
Okay. So, all right.
Oh, and I want to say Cindy Blackstock. Brenda Bear has put that in the chat. So yes, it was Cindy Blackstock that I was quoting her. She's fabulous. If you don't know her, look her up. She is doing great, great work.
Okay, so one of the questions was, what are some changes we can make to these systems to help Indigenous individuals?
Well, I think, you know, there's lots of, I think personally, my personal view is that we need to put more investment in community. And so, you know, we're always suggesting to government, for instance, that, you know, we need to put more investment in community and in neighborhoods and in particularly, you know, Indigenous organizations to build their capacity further into in terms of providing resources and supports for families. And so that's just, you know, and sometimes that can sound like it's complicated, but it's really not. There's a lot of organizations out there that are ready to receive those kinds of resources and are ready to run with it and are running with it, right? So, but it can be political because then sometimes it means you have to unfund stuff, right? And you have to unfund stuff that, you know, isn't working. And for me, you have to take, I think we need to be taking a critical view on how we're measuring things, right? How do we measure what works and what doesn't work and so on and so forth? And like, you know, I talked about the justice system and I talked about child welfare. And so, you know, how much money are we spending on incarceration versus, you know, if we can get upstream a little bit and think about, you know, there was a number, and this is like going way, way back. Gosh, I think these numbers were back in 2008. We did some back of a napkin. And back then it costed like $100,000 to incarcerate a youth for a year. And we thought, gosh, we would never invest $100,000 in a youth to like make them to put them through CEO training, you know, but we'll certainly spend it to incarcerate them for a year. Like that sounds, I don't know, that sounds Pollyanna, I guess, but I'm like, it can literally be that simple.
Usually the answers are usually the simple ones. It's not usually rocket science. So the next question we have is, in the nonprofit sector, do you find that the need to grow and expand programming in order to encourage new funding impacts the lack of research done and the lack of going to community members and asking them what they need?
Is that in this chat? I'm just trying to, that's a bit of a question. So I just want to make sure I got the question right. Kemlin, can you sort of repeat that? Is the need for investment in Indigenous organizations?
It was basically, do you find that the need to grow and expand programming in order to encourage new funding? So basically the pressures of trying to get new funding makes you want to grow and expand. Do you find that that has an impact on the ability for an organization to get research done, and also the ability for the organization to, let's say, step back and ask community members what they need?
Well, I think a couple things there. I do think that if we do the breakdown, like, I mean, you take anything, and I'm I'm a board member at the Winnipeg Foundation. So, you know, I look at what we're doing there, look at, say, the United Way, look at government funding. If we do a breakdown of where all the funding's going, right, that will tell us clearly how much of that is going to, you know, either Indigenous or BIPOC or, you know, like, and those numbers are clear. They say what they say. And so how do we change that, you know, to get us closer to equality? So I think more is needed for sure. I think we need different kinds of funding. And so a lot of the time our programmatic dollars are pretty prescribed to say, here's programming dollars for X. And so you can only do X. And again, here's the committee going, but we want to do Y, but we're going to apply for X because we need the money. So we're going to sort of do X, and but we're kind of going to try to do Y off the side of our desk too while we got X going. So I think, you know, more like sort of self-directed funding, like where the communities can decide or organizations can decide what they need. And so they can determine if they need it for research or this or that or what have you. And we can still be fully accountable, fully transparent. Like you can still have all those pieces if the community gets to decide or the organization gets to decide what they need the funding for. So I'll tell you, Boldness as a social innovation shop, we are super privileged because the money that comes into our organization and that we're using, there isn't a lot of strings attached to it, right? It's you put your money in knowing community will decide what they want to do. We'll tell you all along the way, you know, we'll tell you exactly where every penny was spent. We'll show you all the outcomes. We're going to evaluate and measure in the way that we think is important. We're going to ask the questions we think are important, and we'll let you know about all that, right? But we're going to be in charge of it, and we're going to design it, and we're going to, and so the challenge, so that a lot of our resourcing then doesn't always have to be programmatic. Sometimes we get locked into even programmatic mindsets, right? And we do need programs for sure, but it doesn't only have to be programs. I have seen many not-for-profit organizations, charitable organizations, who keep thinking, how might they be a social enterprise? How might they be a B corporation? They can see lots of the way that they're doing their resourcing could be, you know, something like social enterprise. And I think they see that there's social purpose and they can enterprise around it. Right? We can create enterprise around this social purpose. And so again, I think you folks would know that a lot versus, you know, I'm going to create an enterprise and then maybe try to jam in some social purpose in there, you know? So I see that in our not-for-profits all the time, right? There's a core social purpose, but they can enterprise around it. But a lot of our programmatic funding prevents that, right? And it doesn't allow us to do that. So I think if we're really for real in that driver's seat, I think we can come up with all kinds of creative ways. And so then it becomes this continuum, right? And it becomes like multiple approaches and multiple offerings versus sort of just the single. I talk about lots of what we see, the wisdom that surfaces in Boldness. There's lots of polylithic thinking versus sort of monolithic thinking. You know, that there's can only be one, or it's this, or it's instead, it's like there's these multiple things happening in tandem. I don't know how much of you guys pay, you know, think about the internet and our the way science is moving. But, you know, there was this move from that sort of binary. Well, I guess it's still binary. You know, we moved into the digital world where the sequencing of that binary can go really, really fast. And now we're on the verge of quantum. And so quantum is where it all happens at once, right? And so we're not bound by the sequencing of one after another. Instead, it can all happen at once. So we're talking about like mega computing speeds. Anyway, so, you know, can we get more into our thinking in around quantum versus, you know, sequencing of the binary?
Okay, so another question is, what are some changes we can make to these systems to support Indigenous individuals and communities?
Well, I'll tell you, so I see in the chat here, Pat has said, tell us a specific project the community has asked to do. You know, and I think it might answer the question you've just asked there, Kamlyn. One of the prototypes we worked on was what we called a baby basket. So, and it was around the infant mortality rate. So of course, infant mortality is an issue, and we don't, it's a serious issue, and nobody wants to, you know, have to experience infants passing away, right? And so, but that's happening in our emergency rooms. So a lot of, you know, caring people, doctors, nurses, and others in the health industry, really wanted to do something. Like they were so, you know, driven to act about that. And so they were looking for solutions. And so there's this thing called Baby Box. And, you know, that this is a Finnish thing and it was 1930s and it's very much a part of their culture now. And so it really, you know, I think it's been around since the 30s and I think it really took off, I want to say in the 60s, I think. And so now it's very much part of their culture. And so the Baby Box was designed to address infant mortality. So it's literally a box and it creates a safe sleep surface. Right. And then it's, you know, it's evolved into a couple of other things. But so now that Baby Box concept is available here in Canada. And so again, it's literally a box. There's a couple things in it, you know, that you would possibly want to give to newborn children. And it's standardized. And so we took that idea into our community and said, okay, infant mortality, what do you think about this? Right. And again, that was one of the first times that concept of why would we create a box for a baby to sleep in just to keep the baby alive. Like, and again, it was that survival thinking when we should be thinking about how can families thrive. And when families are thriving, we will bring down the infant mortality rates because we're surrounding families with all the, you know, all the things they need to thrive. And so again, it just changed the conversation. So immediately our community went, we don't want the Baby Box. Instead, we want something else. And then we don't want the standardized box that has four things in it, and which is very transactional because you can go, it was a California company, actually, you can go to their website, click, you know, drag down, order, pay, thing shows up on your doorstep. You got the box, it's got the stuff in it. You bring it into your house and there you go, use it. That's very transactional. They were saying, we want a basket and we want that basket to offer options. And so a person will bring that basket to you and your newborn baby, this family. And in the basket, you can choose. So the families themselves created a list of, I think there's about 20 to 30 things on that list. And families, they designed a point system to all those things. And they said, you know, you have up to 20 points. And so families could pick and choose whatever they wanted, you know, and again, if this is your first child, if you're looking after your grandchild, if this is your 10th kid, I mean, you know, families are at all different places. And so they could really customize what they wanted. And the thing that really surfaced, again, another wisdom that really surfaced in the baby basket concept was the idea of identity. They said identity is one of the key drivers of thriving. And so lots of cultural items were being picked that wouldn't have been, say, in a baby box. And you know those, I can't remember what the name is, those things that you mix water and then you stick your handprint in it and you can stick stones in it. What I can't remember what those things are called. Our families picked that. That was the number one thing. That was the thing that got picked the most, which speaks to that's not basic need, right? I mean, that speaks to identity. And like, it speaks to something else, right? So what are families, if that's the thing that over and over again, families are picking, like that says something to us, right? About what they value and what they think is important. Cause you know, we wanted to say, oh, well, here's a bottle and here's formula and here's, and again, I just got to say this because this is, we got into actually a big fight with that California company. Because at the end of the day, that California company was using the Baby Box. They were going to give it to you for free as long as you signed up for Baby University. And Baby University was just a marketing thing. It was just to say, you know, dress your baby in this, feed your baby that, you know, use this product on your baby. It was all the brand name stuff, right? And so there was no, this was not about health and wellness of children. This was marketing. And so we had to kick them out of a couple of our sessions because they were coming in there just trying to recruit families. And we're like, no, get out. So our community came up with the concept of baby basket. And so that's one of the prototypes that we've worked on. So somebody had asked, you know, something specific that we worked on. That was one of them. So they took the baby basket. And the other thing is they wanted to go further. So we're still iterating. They wanted to go further and call it a baby bundle. There's a lot of teachings around what bundle is and the idea that bundle is lifelong. And actually that you're born, the minute you're born, the second you're born, you were born with your bundle because it's about your spirituality and it's about your life force and about your essence. And so you're born with that bundle and you build that bundle your whole entire life. And you know, some of that bundle is like objects, and some of it's other things like songs, say. So it's very tied to lifelong thriving. It's very tied to identity and culture. And so our community really wanted to take it to bundle, but they recognized that is so relational that they weren't ready to like roll that out just yet, because if they did, they were really fearful of cultural appropriation, and they hadn't figured out how to deal with that yet. So they scaled it, or pulled it back to baby basket. They felt comfortable with basket. They felt, okay, that one we're comfortable with, that one we can put out there, that one we can share, that one we're good with. But there is still this further concept that they want to continue to design for and figure out. So we continue to have those conversations.
That's really
so now we have this baby basket prototype that, you know, we go to government policymakers and everyone else and say, hey, you know, here's this solution that you can invest in. Community wants this, and so let's do more of it.
Yeah, I love that, how, you know, it really is like the story with what you were talking about in terms of the cement, was it? I think it was the stones, you know,
thing, right? And then it hardens, and then you have this permanent thing of your baby's hand or your baby's foot,
right? And that, to me, that really does speak to thriving as opposed to surviving, and how important that is. And and language is so important, right, in terms of just expressing really what you mean, you know. So, okay, I have another question. Are you seeing the development of Indigenous-led investment funds that organizations like Jubilee Fund can reach out to and in partnership?
Yeah, I would say that, Paul Assert is one of the gentlemen that is with Raven, and then his daughter is Sage, actually, and she's the one that is the Sage Initiative. So like father, like daughter there. And the two of them together were the ones that came up with the Moosehide campaign. If those of you are familiar with the little squares of Moosehide, it was those two that came up with that. Mm-hmm. I would say that by and large, most of folks mm-hmm. that I talk to across the country say we need way more, Indigenous-led funds. And, you know, there is, again, it's, you know, I wear all these different hats. I'm very connected to, say, McConnell Family Foundation, and this whole concept of impact investing is, you know, it's raging right now. And so there's lots of opinions about whether, you know, I'm on the board of the Winnipeg Foundation. There's lots of conversations there about it. And so how might we do impact investing? And I do know the McConnell example, you know, they took their endowment and they took a certain percentage of their endowment. And I want to say it might've been either 5% or could have even been 10%. And so they took part of, so they're granting, so great, right? And I think maybe their endowment has allowed them to perhaps grant out, I think, something like $40 million a year kind of thing. But you know, they have like a $900 million endowment. And so, so they're looking at taking a percentage of that endowment, and they're using it for impact investing. And a lot of that impact investing, they are using to invest in Indigenous-led businesses. So I think McConnell's, they did help Raven big time, start their fund and grow their fund. And so, you know, that's a conversation happening all around this world. We talk about decolonizing wealth and decolonizing philanthropy and how might we do it. And so looking at endowments and where are those investments in the endowments. And again, you guys are all into that ethical investing conversation, so you know this. But McConnell, for instance, was saying, well, you know, our measurement is going to be, if we can get 1 out of 10 Indigenous businesses to thrive, that's our metric, right? And so what are the metrics? And then if you dive into Raven Capital, they're toying around, or I shouldn't say toying, they're developing interesting metrics. And so, you know, the 7 grandfather teachings, they're trying to create a metric around love. Like, how do you measure love and creating love in a community? There's that community, and I'm just like, oh, I should know this stuff, but I don't retain the details all the time, that has their, it's their GN, it's not P, it's GNH. It's their, they measure their whole nation based on happiness, right? And so it's not a GNP, and it starts with a G. It's like quantum or something like that.
I've heard of it. Yeah.
Yeah. So their indexing and their ratios are all about measuring happiness of their nation. And they've created metrics around it.
Which is pretty awesome. Much more, much nicer to measure, I think. And also a much better measure of, you know, if people are thriving. So you may have answered this question already, but I'll just ask it. Are there any projects in the works or examples of projects to challenge the current established systems?
Oh yeah. I think a lot of there's a lot out there. I mean, again, the ones that I know about for sure, like I think our Indigenous organizations are offering up a lot of really good solutions and a lot of really good alternatives. And I think at times, you know, they offer those things up in a very friendly way. And at other times, I think they offer those things up in a very challenge, like they're challenging and cage rattling the status quo. And we need the cage rattling, right? Because again, there's this concept out there that power is never given, right? That's always taken. Like, again, I don't whether you believe that or not, like that's a concept. And so that's a discussion to be had. And you know, and so how are we redistributing power and wealth in this country? And is that a very peaceful process or not? And how are we creating pathways for that to happen?
I think I'm at the end of my questions. If you get a chance, then make please do look at the comments. There's lots of great comments, like for you specifically. So I don't know if anyone else has any other questions. And I haven't been watching the time, so I'm not sure where we are in terms of how much time we have.
Yeah, these comments, people are doing the fact checking, so that's great. It's Bhutan, yes, and the Plaster of Paris, and yes, right. All the details in there. So thanks everybody for being the fact checkers. That's awesome.
Okay, Monica put in the chat that we are out of time.
Yeah, again, I'll talk for 5 days if you let me.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time to present tonight, as well as the time to answer questions. Like I said before, it's been really thought-provoking. I think, I think you've also really just left us with a lot of things to kind of consider and think about how we as an organization, but also as individuals and as a community can support your work and support you know, Indigenous people, families and communities thriving. It's been an honor to, you know, have you here and having you share your wisdom and insight with us. And I want to thank you again for your participation and being part of the speakers event for tonight's event. And we hope that everybody has had a chance, that this information has heightened people's understanding and really given people some meat to chew on, as it were.
Well, Kemlyn, I'll just say, like, again, Kichi Miigwech, which is a great big thank you for inviting me. Like, I really do appreciate that there's an interest in this. I do appreciate having been given some space and platform to talk about this, because one of my jokes, I do some work at the University of Winnipeg, and I joked there one time, so I got asked to be at the podium, and I said, you know, there was a time when I had the bullhorn at the back and I was having to always try to kick in the door in order to get into your meetings, and then you guys would change the location, we'd have to find out where you are. You know, there was a time, you know, and now as then here I am today, you're asking me to stand this podium, you're giving me the mic and you're asking me to speak, like, oh my goodness, how times have changed. So anyway, so I always appreciate being asked and given to be afforded some space to say the things I say. So Kichi Miigwech.
Thank you.